You're listening to the University of Liverpool podcast, brought to you by the University of Liverpool online programmes. Make a plan to advance your career today. Study a postgraduate degree with a world-class university without leaving your home or full-time job. You don't have to go far to go further.
This is the University of Liverpool podcast. I'm Neil Morrison. So that's the sound of the moment Miss Mermaid England 2017 was crowned. The winner this year was Laura Sadal from Sheffield. She's the overall winner of the Miss Mermaid UK crown. So she now heads off to Egypt to compete in the Miss Mermaid World pageant. Now, while it's possible you missed that moment, you probably have noticed that mermaids are having their moment lately. You frequently see children at pools wearing a mermaid fin. There are professional mermaids. Yes, that's right. A professional mermaid. It's a paying gig as a mermaid for parties and celebrations. Hollywood has three remakes of Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Mermaid in the works. And the 1984 movie Splash is being remade. This time, Channing Tatum will be the mermaid. Or merman in this case. And it's not just Hollywood.
在远古时代, 人鱼和人类本应和平共处, 谁知道?
The highest-grossing Chinese film of all time was released last year, and it was about a mermaid. So mermaids are everywhere, and to Sarah Peverly, that's not surprising. Sarah Peverly is a professor of English literature at the University of Liverpool. She is working on a history of mermaids in the British Isles.
Mermaids have been with us forever. You know, they've been with us since the dawn of civilization, and they've never really gone out of fashion. It's just that nowadays we have so many more different types of media through which we can access mermaids. So we have social media, we have film culture that's really taken off since the early 20th century. We have music videos, we have songs, we have novels, we have blog posts. There are video games with mermaids in. There's just a much greater number of resources that we can access mermaids through. And this is one of the reasons that it seems like we're seeing them everywhere, but actually they've never really gone away from us. They've always been part of human culture and civilization.
When did your own fascination with mermaids begin?
My own fascination began, I can't remember what age I was. I was probably about 6 or 7. And my parents had hired a VHS video. It was in the days before DVDs. And it was a Japanese anime version of Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Mermaid. It didn't have the Disney ending. It was a few years before Disney produced their Little Mermaid with the famous Ariel in it. This Japanese version was true to the original story, in which the mermaid dies.
Marina, you look so sad. What's the matter? Is the prince going to marry another? Oh, no, Marina, it can't be true. If he marries another, then the morning after his wedding, he'll be turned to foam. Isn't that what the sea witch said? No!
She sacrifices everything for the love of her prince, and she fails in her task to win his heart. He ends up marrying another girl that he thinks had saved him from the shipwreck, when actually it was the Little Mermaid. And that had a profound effect on me, because it was the first fairy tale that I'd encountered where there wasn't a happy ending, and the choices given to the heroine were not choices in it, to me as a child. They were just unhappy endings. She could choose to kill the man that she loves, or to and live without him, or to sacrifice herself and let him live a happy life with his new bride. And as a child, I just it destroyed me. I remember running to the bathroom in floods of tears.
No, I don't believe you have to die. You're too good, Marina. I can't say goodbye forever. I can't.
It taught me that life was not always fair, and life didn't always have happy endings, and that was quite brutal. So it stayed with me, and my fascination with mermaids began then, I think.
There are other half-human, half-animal hybrid creatures that just, they haven't enjoyed the same sustained popularity. You know, the cities like Copenhagen and Vancouver have mermaid statues. They don't have centaur statues. In fact, having a centaur statue would seem a bit odd, whereas a mermaid statue out in the water seems right.
Yes.
So why is it, do you think, that mermaids have managed to have that hold when other hybrid creatures have not?
Well, taking the centaur as an example, that's a half human, half horse, or sometimes half ass creature. And I don't think that's had the same appeal, largely because the centaur lives on land. And you can't imagine the centaur knowing much more than we do. But if you take a hybrid creature like the mermaid that lives in a different element to us, that we can't experience for very long because it's not our natural habitat, there's all sorts of possibilities attached to that concept of this being that is a half human, half animal creature, but the other half of the animal half is native to an element that we don't connect with. I don't know if this is still true, but I've heard before that we know far more about space than we do about the depths of the oceans on our own planet. So I think the mermaid's appeal is linked up with that idea of mystery, that hidden knowledge from us. The mermaid seems to be able to open up different possibilities through inhabiting a different realm to us. But also, of course, being able to cross over to ours and communicate with people.
Right. They're messengers from a realm, a hidden realm.
Yes.
When do they first begin to appear as symbols of hidden knowledge?
They are there from the very earliest records that we have of human civilization. So in the cultures in ancient Mesopotamia, for example, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Akkadians, we have literature, we have religious statues, we have other iconography on things like seals, and merfolk appear there. Largely it's mermen to start with, although there are merwomen as well, but less frequently. And they are associated with creation itself. So in these legends, in the old Mesopotamian mythologies, the merfolk are there in the primordial oceans, the kind of the soup that creates all of living things. And they act as protective guardians. So some of the statues, the earliest statues of them that have been discovered, have been found near foundations of buildings. They have protective prayers written onto them. And they also occur in connection with gods. So the god of the water, he's often surrounded by these creatures. So that idea of them connecting with knowledge beyond man's capability, beyond man's accessibility, is there from the very start. The most famous example that we have of aquatic creatures, which later become mermaids, is the sirens in ancient Greek and Roman mythology. And the sirens become these, when they're first written down, Homer doesn't describe what they look like. So in the very earliest depictions of them, ancient Greek artists used their own imagination. And because Homer had said that they reside near the sea and they destroy sailors with their songs, people connected them with seabirds. So in their earliest incarnations, they are women that are part bird, part woman. Very early on, they get connected with fish-tailed women. So by the 7th century, we have examples of sirens in what we would call a mermaid form, half woman, half fish. Now, the promise of knowledge is the siren's gift, or the siren's lure. So when Odysseus, or Ulysses in the Roman version, is coming back on his way home from the Trojan War, he passes the sirens, but he's been warned to not listen to their song because they cause shipwreck to men and destroy men. And the song that they sing promises knowledge, atemporal knowledge, so it's knowledge beyond past, present and future, it's knowledge of everything. And those that listen to the sirens want this knowledge. It's a quest, it's a beguiling promise. And Ulysses circumvents the destruction by having himself tied to a mast so that he can listen to the siren song but not be destroyed by it, while all his men have to plug their ears with wax and sail past the sirens not listening. And he struggles at one point. He asks his men to loosen his bonds so that he can go to the sirens and receive this knowledge. But of course, they just tie him tighter and sail past them and release him when they're past. So the idea of knowledge is there in a very prominent example that infiltrates all of Western culture after that. So this, the Song of the Sirens continues even to this day. It's used to represent hidden dangers, temptations, lures, and knowledge.
Yeah, to what extent do we continue to see this idea in modern representations of mermaids?
Well, one of the more recent examples in past years has been, it's quite an old film now, I suppose, in those respects, but Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. That's one that sticks in my imagination as a really good example, because the mermaids there come up very seductively to a small fishing boat. They sing a song to the sailors, and one of the crew just wants a mermaid's kiss. And it's only when she pulls him down to have this kiss and descends beneath the waterline that we see the destructive side of mermaids. And she turns into this horrific creature with sharp teeth, quite vampirical in her appearance, who is then going to cause the destruction and death of the sailors. And then the rest of the mermaids all come to attack. So we see it as a prominent symbol still in audiovisual media. It's also used in advertising, of course, quite commonly, and in art and sculptures, video games. So it's still very much with us, and it's endured. There's never been a time that I can think of in our history where the siren myth hasn't been used in some form or reinvented in some form.
In that example, you point out that the mermaids appear at first as beautiful and seductive. And this is certainly how they seem to be presented in modern interpretations. How did that idea come about?
There are examples in medieval society where the mermaids depicted as quite a hideous creature with bird feet and a fish tail in some instances. Very saggy breasts that wouldn't have been appealing to a medieval audience, and features that look quite terrifying, that don't conform to the medieval standard of beauty, which was blonde hair, blue or grey eyes, very slim body. But I think the main part of the siren's appeal as a beautiful creature is used to teach often in various cultures and across various different periods of time, this idea of bad things are often attractive. So going back to the medieval examples that I've just cited, the medieval church used mermaids very frequently to depict sin and salvation. She's often depicted as very beautiful, with long flowing hair, quite often with a comb and a mirror. And the idea is that she's beautiful and attractive, but she has this bestial part hidden beneath the waves that is the dangerous side of her. And very early on in mermaid mythology, we get this concept of the mermaid being aligned with a prostitute. So Isidore of Seville in the early 7th century aligns them with the idea of destroying men. So he says that the sirens that were told about in old stories were not real. They're a symbol for prostitutes who used to lure men to their sort of financial shipwreck by, you know, luring them in for their services. And this idea of the mermaid being this woman to be avoided, this problematic body that typifies all kinds of negative concepts about female sexuality in the medieval period, runs right through. But at the same time, it can be seen in a more virginal context, because of course the virginal part of the mermaid comes from her lower half. She's sexually inaccessible. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have anything that you could usefully use as a man wanting to access this creature. So I think this is part of the interesting thing about mermaids across time. They have this dichotomy. They can be good. They can be evil. They can be virginal. They can be whores.
Yeah, it's fascinating because it's so closely and obviously maps onto society, the tension that exists within culture, I think, up to today, between a woman as being innocent and beautiful on the one hand, or seductive and dangerous on the other. Mm. It's an unresolved tension.
It is,
in culture. And if it's unresolved, do we still see that in more modern depictions of mermaids?
Yeah, a very famous example from the 20th century is René Magritte's painting called The Collective Invention. And this gives us a reverse mermaid. So it plays with this idea of what is appealing, not just to men, but also to humans in terms of the mermaid. Would you rather have, if you were stranded on a desert island, would you rather have the mermaid with the fishy tail and the human body so that you can talk and engage with her? Or would you rather have a mermaid with the lower half as a human woman and the top half as the fish? And this painting depicts this creature washed up on the shore with this awful, monstrous, fishy head and these quite seductive female legs and genitals on display. So it's been something that artists have played with a lot across time. I mean, that's a very extreme example. If we go a bit further back in time from that, we find Victorian artists playing with this erotic aesthetic that goes with the mermaid's body, partly to circumvent censorship. They often use mermaids in their paintings because it was seen as more acceptable to depict a naked woman in a fantastical context. So paintings of mermaids and fairies and other such mythological creatures are quite common topics in that period. And
is that when they first start to be seen and represented in sort of overtly erotic ways?
Well, we have examples of that beforehand. So the medieval ones that I was mentioning before, some of those are quite provocative. You sometimes occasionally get, in the UK, double-tailed mermaids. They're more common in Europe, in a European context on the continent, than in our island group. But the double-tailed mermaid is often shown holding up both of her tails with each hand, in this so sort of splitting her tails almost like legs, and that's inviting this idea of what's between those two tails, you know, just as it would be what's between a woman's legs in a painting or a sculpture. So there are some that could arguably be said to represent an erotic ideal, but certainly it's in the Victorian period that we see this advance a lot more. So we often find paintings where the mermaid will have a full tail, but then there are frequent examples where she only has a very small part of a tail at the end of her toes, or she has no tail at all, but she is still a mermaid. So there are famous pictures of, you know, mermaids luring men in, and they are just naked women. So it's interesting how, you know, how that physical form matters and changes.
Mm-hmm. You know, I find it amazing that the mermaid continues to endure in our modern technological culture. And it makes me wonder, as we continue to sort of lose touch and lose contact with nature and with myths, and we move increasingly towards a technological world, what do you think will happen to the appeal of mermaids? Do you think it'll eventually, drift away in the same way that some other mythological creatures have?
It's very hard to predict, of course, but I'm going to put myself out there and say no. I don't think any kind of technological advances would change our engagement with the imagination, and the mermaid is very much a creature of that. She's a perfect representation of it. She has this, she's a sort of locus of confusion but also unity, so she can be used to explore paradoxes in a way that lots of other fantastical creatures can't be. So the dragon, the unicorn, for example, they can't be used as symbols in quite the same way. And because she has this human half, or of course in the case of mermen, they have a male half, they can help us explore this connection of what it means to be human much more easily, because half of that creature has that humanoid shape. So thinking about people's place in the world is never going to change, no matter how much technology advances. Trying to discover who we are, what we're all about, what life actually means, is one of the some of the questions that the mermaid's been used to interrogate over time. And I don't think technological leaps will change that. Maybe a good historical precedent to support what I'm saying would be in the Age of Enlightenment. So the Age of Discovery, when much more contact with other cultures is happening, when people start thinking of the world and using science to answer questions, there are lots and lots of examples of people sighting mermaids in this period. There are lots of examples of people trying to find out if mermaids are real. And although eventually people conclude that they're not real creatures, that fascination with them doesn't change. We still have people supposedly having mermaid sightings. We still find people like P.T. Barnum and Captain Samuel Eads in the UK exploiting people's fascination with the mermaid and making a lot of money out of exhibiting fake mermaids. So Barnum's famous Fiji mermaid was exhibited in London for several years before it actually went across the Atlantic and was displayed in New York. And it made a heck of a lot of money for people. You know, it was a good earner. And that was in the age where people knew that mermaids were not real, but they were still fascinated with things that could be discovered. So knowing that and having that historical precedent there, I would say no. I don't think our fascination is going to change anytime soon.
Sarah Peverly is a professor of English literature at the University of Liverpool, and she is currently researching the mermaids of British Isles. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
We are going to go out on music composed by Alex Cottrell for an audiobook that Sarah Peverly produced of The Little Mermaid. We will have a link to the music in the program notes for this episode. You can actually hear Sarah Peverly play the harp on one of the tracks. We've just skimmed the surface of mermaid history in this podcast. Sarah Peverly has also written about the political representations of mermaids. We'll include links to a couple of her articles in the program notes. And that's it for this episode of the University of Liverpool podcast. Please rate and review the podcast in iTunes. It really helps us move up the rankings, and that makes it easier for others to find us. I'm Neil Morrison. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
You're listening to the University of Liverpool podcast, brought to you by the University of Liverpool online programmes. Make a plan to advance your career today. Study a postgraduate degree with a world-class university without leaving your home or full-time job. You don't have to go far to go further.